This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Stella Suberman. I'm off to a bad start. Stella, please forgive me. Stella Suberman wanted to title her memoir The Jew Store because that's what everybody called her parents' dry good business in a small town in Tennessee. But her publisher, who was Jewish himself, based in New York City, bristled. He wanted to call it The Jewish Store. Stella stood her ground. The Jew Store isn't particularly a racist slur or simply a Southern colloquialism. It is the semantics of history. Jewish immigrants traveled to the South, selling all kinds of things, until they settled down and opened the one non-grocery retail establishment in town. And these were called Jew stores. Even the Jews called them that. And Stella knew that her title captured a time, place, and spirit that had gone by but should not be forgotten. Stella prevailed. The Jew Store became a bestseller when it was published in 1998. Stella Suberman has a new memoir out. It's called The G.I. Bill Boys, and she joins me in the studio today. Stella, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's wonderful to be with you.
It's a great pleasure to have you here. Your parents' store was in Union City, Tennessee. Where did they come from, and why did they choose that town?
They were, as most of these Jew Store owners, immigrants from the little shtetls of Eastern Europe. And they came, my father first came to New York. My mother was there. And he hated New York. That was a given in our family. And he was he escaped New York, took a boat down to Savannah, Georgia, nestled there for a while, had a very good time, worked for a Jewish merchant, and found out then that there were other Jew store opportunities in the rest of the South. And went back to New York, found a wife, my mother, brought her back, and they settled in Tennessee. And when the owner of one, or a participant in one of the wholesale houses of St. Louis, learned that there was to be a Jew store opening in Union City, Tennessee, he looked around for a go-getter of a salesman, found my father, and said, "Do you want to go to Union City, Tennessee? They're opening a shoe factory there." And my father, of course, didn't even hesitate, just said, "Absolutely." And off he went. We were not yet born, my sister and I, but my brother, older brother and sister were. And so they came in a wagon to Union City and settled there and were there for the next 12 years.
He knew he and his family would be the only Jewish family in town.
I think he knew this. I dare say that most of the Jew store owners also knew that they would be there. There was one to a town. There was one Jew store to a town. And usually they would have merchants, or I should say representatives of manufacturers who would come through now and then. And they would always come to dinner, these Jewish road representatives. And those were the Jews that we knew. I knew almost none. I knew one or two of those, but the rest of the Jewish population was not known to me.
It's just interesting that he would leave a place like New York City, where he could find a lot of camaraderie, a lot of family and community.
I think camaraderie didn't interest him so much as making a living.
Yeah.
And he always said New York insulted him. They did not recognize his abilities, which was in leather. He was very good with shoe leather. And sold to in Russia, he was employed by in a shoe store that sold to the aristocrats and the big men of the town of the area, and made shoes. And my father learned about leather, and thought in New York he would just run this talent of his, and that people would appreciate it, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided to leave.
But he wasn't making shoes then.
No, he wasn't.
In Union City.
In Union City, no, it was the typical Jew store, which was a modest dry goods store that catered to the lower economic elements of the town, the factory hands, the farmers, the sharecroppers, and the Negroes,
and what
as
kind
we
of,
call them then.
What kind of things would you sell in the store?
Well, we sold yard goods, clothing, shoes, nothing. It was not a general store. It was a soft good. We used to call it soft goods, which meant yard goods. And when I say yard goods, I mean bolts of fabric.
Right.
And that was a big seller.
I mean, things sold by the yard, not
exactly.
Chaise lounges and
folding
tables.
No, chaise lounges, not figure into it, no.
Okay. But what idea did he have, or did he, about the hospitality or the lack of it if he goes
he
to a southern town?
He knew he wasn't going to find any real welcome. He knew he was going to have a very difficult time. But as he would tell my mother often, and I can remember this, he would say, "Now, you know, Rebecca, we're not here for entertainment. We're here to make a living." And so the idea was that they were to cooperate in any way they could. And this was true of all Jew store owners. They were very good citizens. They cooperated as they could. They contributed to somebody going to school, to a band uniform, to somebody who had to travel. The contributions came. They would say, "Let's ask the Jew store owners," and they would do this. And that was what they expected to find, and that's what they did find.
Now, the KKK was active?
In our town, it was actually called the Night Riders, which was a sort of branch of the KKK. And they were active, yes. And at meetings, they would have their regular meetings, and my father would say, I would say to my dad in real fear, I'd say, "Oh, Dad, I know about them. They're going to come get us." And he would say, "Well, if they come get us, they'll be in sheets bought at our store." So after a while, I actually lost my fear of them, but I still feared the practice of runnings out of town. Because that was something that we heard about a lot. We didn't have too many in our town. But I knew that there are certain things were non-negotiable in our city. And one of them was the race issue. And if we had taken any side that was not the town side, we would have been run out of town. And so I was scared. So my parents just never mentioned it to us. They never talked about race. They never talked about anything that would stir the emotions of the town. And I think this is one way Jew store owners got by, Jew store families got by.
And the Night Riders made it clear that you weren't to hire African Americans.
My father did hire one African American, Seth. And Seth was a favorite of our family. And he hired him to clerk, actually, which was having a black as a janitor was one thing, but having one as a clerk was something quite different. So Seth stayed in his job, knowing his place, which was to assist, but not to be too authoritative. Well, you know how their demeanor would be. And the Night Riders came to my father one day and said, "You know, this just won't do." They didn't threaten him, but just by saying "this won't do," my father knew what they meant, and that was the end of Seth.
Did you talk about race at home? Clearly,
not
this
at
was
all.
No.
Not at all. They were afraid. I think they were simply afraid that if they did, my mother would have gone. My mother went along with anything that my mother was a timid soul, very shy, and whatever the town proclaimed was fine with her. And if they felt one way about the races, that's the way she would feel. My father was different. But he did not talk about it. He was simply afraid that if he did talk about it, we would talk about it. We children would talk about it. And as I said, it was non-negotiable. You couldn't. You simply couldn't.
Were there any signs of open hostility or antagonism toward your family?
Well, I'm trying to think. Open hostility.
The man that comes closest, it seems to me, is a man who, in your book, and we'll talk about this, you changed the names. Tom Dillon is
Tom
the guy.
Dillon. Yeah. Tom Dillon was a thorn in our side. There was no question about it. And he did not want us there, made that perfectly clear. But the town continued to trade with us. I don't know if it was in spite of Tom Dillon or because they needed, my father always said, well, they need a Jew store, which they did. They had no place to trade. The only store they had was a so-called department store, and it charged, and it charged a lot, but had no credit. You couldn't have a charge account. My father allowed charge accounts. He allowed the blacks to try on clothes. He gave them a lot of credit, I'm talking about paper credit.
Sure.
And but Tom Dillon was just a dyed-in-the-wool hater, bigot. And he was obnoxious to us in many ways, including an almost sexual attack on my sister.
Yeah.
And this was not known to anybody except her and me, not even my mother or father.
And he was a powerful man.
He
owned a lot of.
He was a very powerful man.
Yeah. Other than that, then what about the rest of the community? Were you accepted?
You know,
tolerated?
I thought it was extremely interesting that my mother made her way. By growing flowers. She had a great big beautiful garden that everyone admired, and her first connection, I think, with the townswomen was an exchange of cuttings, of flower cuttings, of plant cuttings, and she eventually ended up with the town garden. Well, you can't be mad at someone who's growing a town garden. And they just appreciated this very much. And as a matter of fact, after we had made a trip out of town to attend a wedding in New York, my mother worried the whole time that her plants were going to waste because she wasn't there to take care of them. And the townswomen, I'm getting a little weepy thinking about this, townswomen got together, collected, harvested all of her fruits and vegetables, and canned them.
I'm talking today with Stella Subramin. She's the best-selling author of The Jew Store. Her newest book is called The G.I. Bill Boys, and we will talk more about her story and her life in the South and now in North Carolina. We'll talk about that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Stella Subramin, author of three memoirs, including the best-selling Jew Store. The newest one is called G.I. Bill Boys. Let's talk about the title of this book, The Jew Store. There are some who might hear that and think it's a rather jarring kind of title.
We all know that there are many, many people who object to using Jew as an adjective. Jew lawyer, Jew accountant. They bridle at this, and I knew that. But the Jew store is a phrase well known to me, comes comfortably to me, rolls off the tongue very easily, and I thought it was a perfect title for that book because the Jew store actually is a character in its own right, the store. But the publishers, Shannon Ravenel, who was my editor, didn't object to it at all because she's from Savannah. She knows about Jew stores. It seemed perfectly logical to her. But my publisher in New York was horrified. And she said, nobody will buy that book with that title. And if they do, they will pass a note to the bookseller. They will not say it out loud. They will pass a note to the bookseller. And then when they read it, they will cover it with a paper bag. Well, I thought, this is really strange. But I did not want to change that title. Yeah. So I said, look, in the South, the word Jew used in Jew store is a perfectly acceptable phrase. And as a matter of fact, people use it just as they would say Greek restaurant. They say Jew store because it meant the modest store that I've just described. Mm. So as evidence, I had a call from trying to beef up my response to this. And I was telling my publisher that I had a call from Dolly Parton, who, as we all know, is a Southerner and, as a matter of fact, a sister Tennessean. And she called. She wanted an option to the book. So, of course, I was doing her a favor. She was not doing mine. So she did not want to insult me. So she said, you know, I saw you on C-SPAN, and I went out and got copies of the book. And then I got copies for all my Jew friends.
There you go.
There was my evidence. And also, I've had the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience in Jackson, Mississippi, took pity on me because they knew I was having such a problem with the title, and they sent me two ads. One of them says, "The old Jew store is closing. Come for the bargains." And the other one says, "The new Jew store is opening. Come for the souvenirs." This was from two Alabama stores. Mm. And so I felt vindicated. And finally, The publisher agreed that it was a good title. I had talked to a bookstore owner, a Jewish bookstore owner, and I said, from New York, and I said, how do you feel about this title? He said, I love it.
So you prevailed. And,
I prevailed.
And it became a bestseller.
It did.
So you didn't have to – the Jewish store would have been – that would have
terrible,
just been silly.
Terrible,
yeah.
Terrible.
So and so we talk about, again, the families and how you were received. You talked about your mother's mm-hmm. garden, the mm-hmm. fact that you mm-hmm. had been pretty well warmly received there. Well, I know we've done stories and talked with people before on the Jewish experience here. And one of the things that comes up is the fact that – the local folks, especially the church folk, thought, well, there's something special about the Jews because, after all, they learned to speak Hebrew, and won't they know more about our own scripture than we do? Was that an experience that you had at all?
Well, you know, my folks were really not religious, and so they were not very a very good source for religious teachings. But my brother had a wonderful experience. He was sent to New York for my mother. Although she was really not terribly religious, she insisted on all the rites and ceremonies and so on and so forth. She couldn't keep kosher, of course, because that would have been impossible in our little town. But she sent my brother to New York for his bar mitzvah. And when he came back, he became the most popular dinner guest in town. he would be invited everywhere because they wanted him to say the preprandial prayers. And they would say, and the father would say, listen, children, Will is going to be speaking the language of our Lord, and because he had learned Hebrew in New York. So Will would come home and he would say, you know, they said that I was speaking the language of their Lord. They don't know that the language of their Lord is Aramaic. I said, well, did you teach them that? And he said, no, of course not. I'm a good Southern gentleman.
So he got many more dinner invitations,
oh,
I guess.
He was the big hit all over town, yes.
Now, you remain faithful to the title of the book, but you did feel the need to change many of the names, including the town.
I did.
Concordia,
it was
Tennessee,
a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Very hard thing to do. Because as a Washington Post reviewer said, why did she bother changing the names of everybody? Everybody in that town is – everybody she writes about is dead. Well, surely they were dead, but their progeny were not. And I didn't – and there were a lot of little, you know, funny little stories in that book that wouldn't go over well, I think, with progeny. And so I decided to change not only the name of the characters in the book, but also the name of the town. And it's been a problem. I just would never do it again.
Well, one of your sisters had to be just about written out of the book because
she was almost exactly the same age as I, and it was just too much of a burden to have to report two little girls of the same age. So I just combined our names. I was Stella and she was Ruth. So I became Stella Ruth.
You did have encounters, though. You tell a story about actually meeting somebody from the town who's
yes,
featured
did.
In the book
yes,
in
I
a
did.
Very unflattering way.
Another unintended consequence. mm-hmm. I was in St. Louis talking to the Jewish Community Center, a wonderful group of people. And it happened to be a very large group, too. And I was giving this talk and having a wonderful time and getting a wonderful response. And then I went in for the book signing, and here came this young woman, not young woman, but a woman younger than I, with a book under her arm, ready to have it signed. So she came up and she said, I almost died when you said you were from Union City. She said, you know, that's just over the border from my hometown, which was Fulton, Kentucky. I said, your hometown? She said, yes, Fulton, Kentucky. So I said, my goodness, you're in that book. Are you a Casno? And she said, yes. I said, you're in that book. And she said, oh, I can't wait to read it. Well, by this time, my heart was sinking because in the book, her mother is not treated very well. So I said, my mother really did not like her. And so I thought, what am I going to say to this woman? So I said, I'm afraid your mother doesn't come off too well in the book. And she said, she looked at me very hard. And she said, my mother was a saint.
There you go. There you go. So this
nothing
is not
I
the book.
Do about
don't
that.
Know if you made a sale on that one.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, the family did leave Tennessee. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was basically because of the Depression. But the ostensible reason was that my sister was becoming of marriageable age, and there were no Jewish boys. And my mother took us to that haven of Jewish boys, which was New York. And we stayed there very briefly. And that sort of led into this current book, because that was the Depression story. This was the Depression really chased us out of Union City. And we got to New York, stayed briefly. My father found a very inappropriate business, hated it. We left again and went down south, what he thought was the South, which was Miami, Florida, which was had no connection to the South at all, but there we were.
And what was he doing there?
Well, he bought some property, first of all, and established some stores, and I hoped that one of them would have been a Jew store, but it was not. He bought a drugstore, and which was on the on the street that connected Miami to the town, Miami to Miami Beach. We lived on Miami Beach. I went to school there, and it was a very interesting town for us because we felt we were country folks set down in a very glamorous spot and a very glitzy spot, and we didn't quite know how to behave at first, but soon got the knack of it.
Was it difficult and uncomfortable for you, or was it
a
was
little
it exciting?
Bit, a little bit, but it was all in the service of learning something. You know, we learned a lot, and we learned to be with Jews. That was another thing. Jews who were not our relatives in New York, we were with Jews, but they were all our relatives. But in Miami, they were not our relatives, and we had to learn to be with non-Jews and Jews in a different way, in a very different way.
What did that
way.
Mean? How did that change things for you?
Well, my mother was happy because we were surrounded by, she had a temple to go to, a little synagogue down on South Beach, the one and only. It was not a temple, it was a synagogue. And there was a big temple in town, and we heard a lot about that. And there were a lot of Jewish hotel owners. The Jews in Miami Beach were quite well-to-do, quite well-to-do. They owned things.
When you say, though, you had to learn how to live among Jews who weren't your family, what did you have
well,
to learn?
Well, I had to learn, for instance, about things like signs on the hotels that said no Jews allowed. Had to learn about that. And I had to learn about tourists who came down and rich tourists who brought their children and were in school with us. And we had to learn to get along with rich people.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know any rich people. In Union City, we didn't have any really rich people. But these were rich.
Well, you talked about having a synagogue and a temple in Miami. Mm-hmm. No such thing in Union City. And you tell a great story in the book, The Jew Store, about a woman in town who said, oh, we got every kind of church except a Jewish church. But she really
actually,
didn't
they had
have
every kind of church except the Episcopal Church.
And the Catholic Church.
definitely no Catholic. Actually, you know, you're bringing up an interesting point that the Catholics, I think, were more of an anathema to non-Jews than, I mean, to Southerners than Jews.
Klan was not happy with.
Klan was
yeah,
not
no,
happy
no.
with.
They didn't like
with
those papists.
Yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And not that we had ever seen a Catholic, not that we had ever known a Catholic, but the Klan or the Knight Riders would tell us to stay alert in case of a sneak attack. A Catholic might come to town, and then what are we going to do?
And we don't know what they're hiding under those mitres.
Yes, that too.
You talked about the Great Depression, too, and that it really caused a personality change.
Can I just say, talk about Catholics?
Yeah.
We were there where the Holland Tunnel was built in New York, and when the story got to us down there in Union City, Tennessee, it was said to connect New York with Rome,
uh-huh.
The tunnel was built to connect the papacy to the Catholic members in New York. So we had our problems with Catholics. Even I had a problem with Catholics. And I carried that to Miami Beach. I carried my fear of Catholics to Mama Beach, but there happened to be a Catholic high school, and they interacted with us socially. So,
did that fear come from Jews who had told you about anti-Semitism?
It came from the Klan.
Yeah, yeah, that fear.
And everybody had picked up on that theme from the Klan, and so I was willing to go along with it.
Did things change for you when you finally ran into a few in Miami?
Yes, yeah. In Miami, I ran into the. We had a very interesting Catholic community down there. We had Al Capone.
Good Catholic.
And his henchmen, yeah. Exactly. He was not exactly residing in Miami Beach at the time. He was in some federal penitentiary on the tax evasion charge. But we had a Catholic high school, and we enter, as I said, Desi Arnaz was in that school. Good Catholic boy. And, we were fine with them.
The Depression, though, forced the move out of Tennessee, initially to New York, then ultimately Miami. You said it had a change, really changed your parents' personality, did it?
The Depression, yes, it did.
How so?
They became very fearful. I'm sure they were not alone in this change, but the Depression acted upon all of us in a very deep and profound way. Dreams were gone. Everything was make do. We talked about the depression as my husband would talk about it, because we knew each other then. We knew each other when we were very young. He would talk about the Depression as a living thing, as something that had entered our lives as a living thing, and it actually was that. We always consulted with it. Would the Depression allow this? Could we afford this? Would the Depression permit this to happen or that to happen? It was an ongoing thing, a vital thing in our lives.
And you mentioned your husband, Jack, who you met in Miami.
We met in Miami, right. His father was down there for his health. He had had what we called a depression heart attack, lost his business, came to Miami. Well, there's a typical story, because the Depression had a lot of typical stories, and this was one of them.
You met, and again, the Depression and the war had an impact on your decision to get married and when.
Well, the war actually enabled us and many couples to get married. Couples who had been going together for a long time couldn't even discuss marriage because there was no living to support a marriage. But when the war came along and the men signed, there was an immediate rush to marriage, and we were among those. So the war was declared in December 7th, 1941, and we were married end of January 1942.
You said that the war had a unifying effect, or did it? And maybe that's my question to you. In terms of religion, did Jack feel particularly Jewish during the war as a soldier?
I think he did. Yeah? I think he did. I think he did. I think he was used to it, of course, because colleges then had that quota system. And some coy arrangement where Jews would be allowed in according to their presence in the population. And so he was sort of used to that and expected that. And actually, when the GI Bill came along, we all looked to see whether there was a quota in the GI Bill. And, of course, we didn't find one. I mean, the GI Bill was amazing.
And you say it really wasn't well publicized. You practically stumbled over it.
It was not. It was... I think some people would say it was because they knew about it. Yeah. They knew about it from some source. We did not. And none of the people we knew, the returning war veterans who had gathered together back in their hometowns, in our case in Miami Beach, and they would gather together and deplore the situation. The war factories had closed. There were no jobs. The people who had been in college didn't want to go back. First of all, they couldn't afford it. Second of all, they said, we've been men in the service. How can we go back to being college boys? It was very hard for them. And they didn't see any future anyway, even if they had gone back to college and studied and worked hard. There wouldn't have been any jobs at the end of it all. So where were we, Frank?
We're going to find out why Jack decided to take up the GI Bill and actually go back to school.
He didn't at first. He did not want to do that for the very reason I was just describing, that he didn't want to be a boy again.
Yeah.
He had a child, and he wanted to. And his field of interest was English literature. Well, to make some sort of living in English literature, one would have to have graduate degrees and so on and so forth. This was not would not be available to him because he had no money. So he took a job finally. Everybody got tired of not having a job. So he took a job finally in a rug factory, a rug warehouse, I should say. And it was from that warehouse that he finally set out on the road to Camp Landing, where he was to get his separation papers and where he found the GI Bill. And that was the answer to everything.
Eventually ended up at the University of North Carolina.
He certainly did. He had taken a job because he was ready to take a job. He had his master's degree from the University of Florida, and he was feeling the pressure of a job and didn't see himself as getting into any. He was in a quandary, but an old professor of his at the University of Florida had taken over as the head of the English department at Chapel Hill. And sent for him. They were old. They were old Army. Cliff was in the Navy. Jack was in the Army Air Force, Air Corps, as it was called then. And they had military to talk about. They had sports to talk about. Cliff loved Jack. Loved that he was interested in the same things. He said, "Come to Chapel Hill. I'll take care of you. You'll have a wonderful time." And we did. We never would have expected that.
We'll pick up the story from there when our program continues. I'm talking with writer Stella Suberman, who is author of the bestseller, The Jew Store, her newest book, G.I. Bill Boys. Our conversation continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest is Stella Suberman, author of three memoirs, the latest called The G.I. Bill Boys. Where'd the title of that book come from?
Well, it's about the G.I. Bill. And it's about the lives of the G.I. Bill boys, returning war veterans who took advantage of the bill. And I talk about them, trace their lives as they applied themselves to the bill and as they educated themselves. You know, the G.I. Bill was an amazing. It was magnanimous. It was munificent. It was all those M words. It was magnificent is the word for it. Because it not only gave these boys a future, these returning war veterans of World War II, it also, in a way, this sounds too grand, I think, but it also changed America, changed the middle class of America from a feeble one to a robust one. This was terribly important. And when I wrote the book, I realized I had a hard time with the title. I'll have to tell you a story about the title. I always have trouble with my titles. Everybody does, I think. I was satisfied with the title because I knew it was basically about the GI Bill. And it was the GI Bill was the star of that book. And it was being read. It was being read by a peer reviewer at the University of Tennessee Press, and he said, "This is a terrible title." I was happy with it. He was not, and he said, "Calling this book the GI Bill Boys is like calling Gone with the Wind Sherman's attack on Atlanta."
See,
so I knew. But I still was convinced that I had to have G.I. Bill in the title. Well, the fact was he was somewhat right. He was absolutely right. Because in the book, I knew I had to trace the reasons for the G.I. Bill. I had to go back to the Depression. I had to go back to World War II. I had to go back to Roosevelt and the New Deal. I had to go back to World War I and the Bonus March on Washington. All of that contributed to the G.I. Bill. If it hadn't been for those things and people with long memories, we would not have had a G.I. Bill. So I had to do that. And so I felt the G.I. Bill, I wanted G.I. Bill in the title. I had thought maybe a brand new America. So I tried that out on a friend of mine who is a book editor down in South Florida. I said, "Scott, what do you think of this title? Brand New America, he said, I think it's a bit medicinal.
It does sound, or Reagan-esque, I guess, one way or another. You should have stuck with the success of the first book. See, you had the Jew store, and then you could have done Jack Superman, G.I. Jew. No? I'm sorry, Stella. I'm sorry. It just occurred to me it could have worked. Anyway, yes, the book is a fine book. The
G.I. Bill. But I wouldn't have.
I don't think you should have. Good book. And you talked about Jack does come to the University of North Carolina, in part because he'd heard about the reputation
of
Frank Porter
Graham.
Yes,
I shouldn't give too much credit to Cliff Lyons.
Well, no, that,
I do
it's
give
good
some,
to have a friend here, right?
Right, exactly. But a lot of credit goes to Frank Porter Graham because we knew about him. And we knew that he had a very liberal sensitivity, and everything we heard about him was good. We knew he was good for education. We knew he was good for English literature. We knew he was good. He would be a good guy for Jack to hook up with. And then, through my father, we knew about Harry Golden, who was a very prominent North Carolinian.
Publisher in Charlotte of a newspaper called
right,
the Carolina Israelite.
Which my father subscribed to. Yeah. My father wanted to keep up with Southern Jews. And so later on, this was after Jack had I think can't remember whether he was still in school or somewhat later, Harry Jack called him the Mark Twain of Southern literature, something. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Mark Twain of Southern literature, because he had these schemes whereby the races would mix in an acceptable way, and they were very funny. He was a wonderful writer.
Of course, you document this in your book, but one of his most famous schemes, I'll have you tell the story, about how to end segregation because of the way the law was written, right? The way you could,
Was it the vertical plan or the black carrying the white baby? Which one?
Well, either one of those is good, but
the
vertical plan.
The white baby plan, where a black person carrying a white baby could go anywhere, sit anywhere, be anywhere, do anything. Okay, that was the white baby plan. Then there was the vertical plan, in which Harry said, it seems to be no problem when blacks and whites are sitting together, but it's not a problem when they're standing together. Right. So let's take all the chairs out of the classroom. He was very funny.
And you know, it was the Jewish mayor of New York, of Durham.
Durham, exactly.
Mutt Evans, who owned a store with a restaurant in it. And he actually did that. He took this because the
Oh,
way
did
the,
he? Did he actually? I did not know
he
that.
He did that. Mutt Evans actually had been reading The Israelite and thought that was a great idea. And of course, the law said that blacks and whites may not sit together in a restaurant. So, you take the stools
That's
out and
right.
they're not sitting together
That's
anymore. And Mutt Evans took Harry Golden's advice
well,
and actually did
out?
That. It worked out very well. Mutt became the mayor of Durham. And
Six times. Was mayor of Durham. My father was so impressed with that.
Well, and it had to do, I think, and you may know more about this than I, but the idea that really a lot of business owners didn't like segregation. It cut into business.
It certainly did.
And they were looking for ways around these laws that would also save face because there's a huge amount of social pressure brought to bear. So it's interesting that a kind of outsider, that it's the Jewish newspaper that mm-hmm. can actually offer this kind of critique that leads the way to desegregation. It's the Jewish newspaper and not, the
Baptist.
Yeah,
but Harry Golden was kind of one in a million. Yeah. He really was quite – because he was funny.
When did you start writing?
I've always written. All my jobs involved writing. I worked for the North Carolina Museum of Art as did their publications, did their press releases, went down to the University of Miami, worked for the Low Art Gallery where I did the same job. And when I retired – although I was playing a lot of tennis, it didn't seem to be very satisfactory. When people like to write, they just like to write, and I like to write.
Was it difficult for you to put these memoirs together? You came at them a while after the events had taken place.
Well, yes, but I always knew that story about Southern Jew stores had to be told. It was told the guy from Atlanta, who very well-known Jewish writer, slips in my mind right now. When he wrote about Atlanta Jews, it was a whole different story. Atlanta Jews are different. I mean, they have a variety of temples. They have a variety of levels of economics. The whole Jewish situation is different. So, but the Jew story is a story unto itself. It's about, as you said, it's about immigrant Jews coming to the South and opening particular kinds of stores. And that story, to my mind, had never been told. I knew it was an interesting story. I wanted to tell it. And interestingly, at the same time I wrote that, The Peddler's Grandson was being published in Mississippi it always comes to mind when I think how happy I am in North Carolina, how I feel the people are so good here, good and kind and wonderful, love being among them. And I read it was emphasized in this book, The Peddler's Grandson, by a man who became a friend of mine, who grew up Jewish in Mississippi, and he said that. Although he had his problems his father had a problem as Jewish storekeeper, he said that he always feels that when he's in trouble and he's surrounded and in a place where he's surrounded by strangers and in a place where he doesn't know where help is coming from, he always listens out for a Southern voice, and when he hears it, he knows help is at hand. That made me feel really, really good. I don't know where that story, why I inserted that story, but it's such an important story to me that I wanted to tell it.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story, and I think it tells you something about this notion of hospitality, but also some things that people not from the South find a little cloying or annoying. The fact that Southerners are not direct, that this courtesy is sometimes a mask for something else, you know,
I don't know that it's a mask.
But it is a way of providing comfort.
Yes.
They weren't throwing things at your store and calling you names every day.
Yes, exactly. And Southerners have this talent. They, and that's, you know, when people say, well, weren't you insulted by people calling you Jew or the store being called the Jew store? I was not. I was never insulted. People would not do that to me. What they said behind their closed doors, I do not know. I did not know. I do not know. But in general, I felt, you know, very comfortable.
You make a couple of points in your other books. Certainly the Jew store talks about that particular phenomenon and its impact. But when you move on, when it was our war, for instance, and then the GI Bill boys, it seems to me that you're making some larger points, particularly GI Bill boys. You just said it. The GI Bill created a middle class. It allowed people to get an education. And there's a bigger story to tell there because we see it so much more difficult. Higher education is becoming more expensive, mm-hmm. even in state schools. Mm-hmm. There's a real threat to that middle class because of our economic policies these days.
We have seen its zenith, budgets. I think. We have seen the zenith. We're now anticipating a fall. The middle class is falling apart. But, you know, the interesting thing in terms of the military, because that's what that book really is about. Well, it's about that and not about that. It's about a lot of things. I'll tell that story some other time. I've got a lot of things to tell.
Were you going to tell a story? Will you tell the story of the title of the book? And I don't mean to derail you now, but When It Was Our War.
Yeah, When It Was Our War suited me, suited the title, suited me, suited the publisher. We were all very happy with it until the tagline came along. Somebody decided to attach a tagline to it, which read, When It Was Our War, A Soldier's Wife on the Home Front. This made my hair stand up. I said, what is it? Do they really think it's about us stay-at-homes who were counting ration stamps, however you pronounce that word? I mean, this is what it suggested to me. But there wasn't anything I could do about it because it was already on the book when I saw it. So, but the interesting thing about that is that invariably, when I saw that title in print with the tagline attached, it said, When It Was Our War, A Soldier's Life on the Home Front, which makes no sense at all.
Soldier's Life on the Home Front, yeah.
How does a soldier have a life on the home front?
Yeah. So you have trouble with all your titles.
All my titles.
You're not going to consult me anymore. I know that. But there are some deeper lessons in all of this. Even that, you point to who was fighting in World War II, and it was a broad cross-section. Now we're fighting wars, and again, a tiny, tiny fraction of our population. Most of us are utterly isolated from the impact of these wars,
and
not like World War II.
And you know, Frank, it occurs to me that the only thing that's going to change that, and this sounds like a really terrible thing to say, is to have a draft. If you have a draft, you're not going to have a whole lot of wars.
Well, you could just stop fighting wars.
But nobody's going to stop fighting wars. We seem to have a basic need to fight wars. But if we have a draft, you know, if everybody's kid goes to war, it's a whole different story. Yeah. And everybody's kid is not going to war now.
Well, and it's if you ever needed proof that you're protecting privilege more than anything, it's just see who's fighting the war. If it was really about these great ideals, then we would all be invested, even those who are at the highest levels of office. But it could be an argument for privilege.
World War II had very few deferments, and you could not get them on in terms of because of your status in the government or wherever. Everybody just went.
And you talk about the importance of the New Deal, which is something we don't think about or talk about much these days.
Well, you know, I talk about it in reference to the Depression, because I feel that the Depression was what gave us the GI Bill. The Depression was the progenitor. It was the father, the master plotter for the GI Bill. Because the actually started even before the Depression. It started with the World War One. When the veterans came home from World War One, there was no future. There was no job. The Depression had started. They came to Washington in the Bonus March, and they didn't get what they wanted.
Right.
And they established what we would call now they occupied Washington in order to get their bonuses. They didn't get them. And then we had a change of government. We had Hoover giving way to Roosevelt. And then we thought, he's going to give the veterans everything they want. He did not. He instead instituted the New Deal. Well, that was fine, too, because we felt there were jobs to be available. Well, there weren't enough jobs. He was trying his best. In this way, Roosevelt was really working hard. We had programs that came down by the millions. I even worked for one. I worked for what was called the National Youth Administration, and it was gender blind. It was race blind. It was artists could get jobs. Writers got jobs. Small jobs, small pay, but jobs. The CCC, the WPA, Works Progress Administration, administered everything. But you know what happened was what we see today, and that is that instead of spending money to supply jobs, which is what we need, that we're saving. What are we saving money for? We can't just tuck ourselves away and say, "Oh no, we're not going to spend any money." Because we deprive ourselves of those jobs that we need so desperately. And that's what happened to Roosevelt. He began to listen to those people, to those voices that were saying, "You're spending too much money. You can't spend all that money. You've just got to pull back." And when he pulled back, what happened, coincidentally, was that the war came along. And then there was no depression. Then the depression disappeared.
Stella, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
I rattled on and on and on because you made me do it, Frank. You're so good to talk to.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, and it was wonderful. You go back and listen to this. You're going to love every second of it. Stella Superman is the author of three memoirs, including the best-selling Jew Store, her newest book, The G.I. Bill Boys. She reads at McIntyre's Books at Farrington Village, Saturday, August 25th at 2 o'clock. Thank you for listening to our program. It's The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.